It really worked well. yeah.
Well,
more on that later. Next week, we may have a special replay of an alternative radio segment. I've been having a little difficulty planning my holiday. I'm going to be out of town next weekend, and David's not authorized to operate the he's got to take the class.
It's nothing political.
Yeah, I wanted to do a call-in from Madison and talk about conspiracist theories and breathing the air without breathing the air in the studio, actually. Getting more people in here, too, I guess. Thanks for listening. We'll see what happens. Hope you have a good holiday. Remember, the pilgrims were dining with an Indian tribe celebrating their victory over another Indian tribe that they had just wiped out. So I don't know. I hope that doesn't ruin your digestion entirely.
Yeah.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the November 20th, 2010 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed on this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinion of WEFT's management or board of directors. Now here's Tom with acknowledgement of some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, I'm your host, Bob Pelesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week is entitled, When Will Representatives Represent? Also with us here today is a co-host and new to the program, Jason Kozlowski. We're very glad to have you here, Jason. And he'll have some news and some additional stories and commentary for us later in the show. Jason, thanks for joining the collective here.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent, excellent. And Dave is laboring today, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And Bill is probably doing the same. So
hear that or he's on his way here.
Yeah, could be, could be. So now here's Tom to kick off this week's Workers' Interest News.
A half dozen Illinois locations have expressed interest in hosting a carbon dioxide storage facility for the Future Gen Clean Coal Project that could mean more than 1,000 short-term jobs and a few dozen permanent ones. One of the bidders is Tuscola, along with Douglas County. According to Future Gen CEO Ken Humphreys, Future Gen is looking forward to making an announcement on the final site early in 2011. Until earlier this year, the plan had called for building a new power plant in Mattoon and storing the carbon dioxide it produced just outside of town. But the Department of Energy decided instead to use $1.2 billion in federal stimulus funding to refit an existing coal-burning Ameren plant in Meredosia with different technology and pipe the carbon dioxide, a major greenhouse gas, to another location for underground storage. The storage site would also become home to an education center to train people to build and maintain carbon dioxide pipelines. A spokesperson from the Energy Department said that with the delays in the Future Gen project, other projects had already bypassed the technology it had planned to use in Mattoon. Therefore, Tuscola is in the running, and there are a lot of people in the area hoping for those jobs.
From Ireland, an emergency team of up to a dozen IMF officials arrived in Dublin to finalize details of a 100 billion euro deal to bail out banks and the country. And as a result, thousands of public sector workers are at risk of pay cuts and job losses in the aftermath of drastic measures likely to be imposed. All workers face higher taxes as the EU and the IMF will oversee at least 15 billion euros in budget cutbacks over the next 4 years. At the same time, the International Monetary Fund will sanction emergency cash for the banks in a massive effort to restore confidence in the public sector. Yet thousands of public sector workers, including teachers and police and nurses, face wage cuts and possible redundancies as part of the new $100 billion bailout package. Yet world markets on the news of this had surged of the imminent bailout. As the deputy director of the Agency of European Department led the IMF Dublin mission and held missions at the central bank, IMF spokesperson Caroline Atkinson insisted a bailout would not ignore the potential impact of savage cuts on the least well-off, saying, quote, over the last couple of years, we've been very focused on the need for what we've been calling social conditioning, the need to protect the very poorest and most vulnerable. referring to this as medicine, said, we all get sick. We get called in because the patient is sick. We have some medicine, which is the liquidity and the funds that we can provide, but we also have to suggest some other measures that may sometimes be difficult for countries to implement. Meanwhile, unions not in the mood for such a prescription are threatening to call on the Irish Congress of trade unions to launch campaigns of civil disobedience should the president not call for new elections.
Thanks, Jason. I got a story here about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and we've reported on those folks several times over the last five or 6 years.
Yeah, I was going to say it's been pretty steady.
It seems like they finally got a major victory here. It says a far-reaching agreement with the industry group most responsible for blocking progress in Florida's tomato fields will bring improved pay and conditions to 90% of tomato pickers. In a stunning advance, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers arrived at a far-reaching agreement with the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange, the tomato industry group most responsible for blocking farm worker progress. The groups announced the pact on November 16th press conference in Immokalee, Florida. Because FTGE represents almost all tomato growers in Florida, CIW estimates the agreement will improve pay and working conditions in 90% of Florida's tomato industry. The CIW's combination of worker-led organizing in the fields, tireless education and publicity among farm workers about farm workers' conditions among the general public, and coalitions with student and community groups resulted in a series of agreements from food companies to pay an extra penny a pound for tomatoes. The first company targeted, Taco Bell's owner Yum Brands, finally agreed to pay a penny more per pound of tomatoes after a 4-year boycott campaign started in 2001. McDonald's agreed 2 years later, then Burger King, Whole Foods Market, and Subway. Since last year, all the big food service companies have signed on, Bon Appetit, Compass, Aramark, and this past August, Sodexo. But until the tomato growers got on board, there was no guarantee that the extra money paid by these corporations would actually reach the workers. An extra penny per pound amounts to a 60% raise for farm workers, who are paid around 50 cents for a 32-pound bucket of tomatoes. So, well, that is good news, though.
They get a whole another 30 cents.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, a penny a pound, so yeah. Yeah, that's a 60% raise.
Yeah.
All right, Tom.
Hey, according to testimony before a congressional committee, foreclosures are hitting homeowners who are not in default, and banks are tacking on excessive fees that can actually drive borrowers into foreclosure. National Consumer Law Center spokesperson Diane Thompson told the Senate Banking Committee that foreclosures against homeowners who are not in legal default are a widespread problem. She said 10% of the cases she handles involve homeowners who are not in default and in any way when foreclosures are initiated. The congressional hearing on problems with foreclosures and mortgage modifications followed recent revelations that some mortgage companies, amongst them Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and GMAC Mortgage, had filed faulty legal papers in tens of thousands of foreclosure cases. The state attorney generals of all 50 states recently launched a nationwide investigation into foreclosure practices and are also probing borrowers' complaints about long delays and lost paperwork that have plagued mortgage modification cases. One possible outcome, positive in most respects, is an agreement between banks and state attorney generals to improve their modification processes.
Last week, over 400 hotel workers and supporters assembled in downtown Washington, D.C. to demand a fair contract as area hotels, including Hilton, Marriott, Hyatt, Starwood, and others, attempted to push through concessionary contracts, despite having restored their pre-recession levels of profit. The action was organized by Unite Here Local 25, which represents over 4,500 hotel workers who have been in contract negotiations since August. Demonstrations marched to three nearby hotels in the thick of rush hour traffic. Local 25's Bradley Van Wals described the situation faced by workers, saying, quote, despite returning to their pre-recession profitability and occupancy levels, hotel management is insisting that workers accept a recessionary contract. They've made several contract proposals that would trigger increases in workload to staff already stretched thin, he said. The proposals that management is trying to implement will add no additional contributions to workers' pensions and offers a first-year wage increase of less than 1%, which covers less than the latest Metro Rail fare increase. On top of these concessions, Marriott is particularly looking for a free hand to outsource to temporary low-wage labor. Hotel Workers Fight in D.C. is part of a larger campaign as workers across the industry nationwide face a brutal offensive by industry leaders looking to expand profits by keeping labor costs down. These workers in D.C. have been at the forefront of a new wave of worker militancy opposing these concessions as bolder actions not seen in decades are being taken. In June alone, up to 1,000 hotel workers and their supporters across the country were arrested in coordinated civil disobedience actions. Similarly, a rising number of wildcat strikes by non-union hotel workers have been taking place. One particularly successful in California at Embassy Suites in Irvine this summer resulted in some immediate improvements in their working conditions.
So I got a story here that the Paycheck Fairness Act was blocked by a Republican filibuster. Senate Republicans succeeded in blocking a measure designed to reduce wage disparities between men and women. Senate Democrats were unable to overcome a Republican filibuster of the Paycheck Fairness Act on Tuesday, the 58-41 vote falling two votes short of the 60 needed to end debate and proceed to a vote on the measure that would help combat wage discrimination on the basis of gender. The vote broke down along party lines, with the exception of Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska, who sided with Republicans and voted against cloture. Not a single member of the GOP broke rank. Observers closely watched the votes of Senators Susan Collins, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, and Olympia Snowe, all women senators who voted for the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which provides basic protections against wage discrimination. Civil rights groups, labor leaders, and the Obama administration all supported the bill, which would make employers prove that any disparities in wages are job-related and not sex-based. The federal government reports that women make 77 cents for every dollar earned by men. The bill would have made it easier for women to file class action suits against employers and would have lifted the cap on damages. It also called on businesses to share salary information with the government. And there was a statement from President Obama who said, "I'm deeply disappointed that a minority of senators have prevented the Paycheck Fairness Act and finally being brought up for a debate and receiving a vote. This bill passed in the House almost 2 years ago. It had 58 votes to move forward, the support of the majority of the Senate, and the support of the majority of Americans. The bill was one of the first measures passed by the House last year after President Barack Obama was elected." And the Republicans and business groups said the bill would expose employers to more litigation by removing limits on punitive and compensatory damage awards. Senator Susan Collins said in a statement, she says, "However, I'm concerned that this particular legislation would unnecessarily impose increased costs and restrictions on small businesses. By eliminating caps on punitive and compensatory damages, this bill would expose the small business community to excessive litigation, force employers to devote significantly more resources towards legal protections, and could stunt job creation." Personally, I have to wonder why these companies don't just stand up and do the right thing and pay women an equal wage. Then they wouldn't have to worry about all this excessive litigation costs.
It'd be a lot cheaper for them.
They'd just stay out of court then. They wouldn't have to pay all the litigation costs.
Yeah. Oh, another one, too. It's really too bad the Democrats lost all those seats because, obviously, they got so much done. I mean, I know it did get through the House, but what's the point in winning the House?
Evidently, you know? Not much, Bill.
Yeah. Well, I just hope that the Democrats in the Senate have the gonads to stand up to the Republicans when those people start putting their rapacious paws on our paychecks.
Some of those people are saying these days? Man up?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
Hey, Britain has agreed to pay monumental legal settlements to British citizens who were held at Guantanamo Bay and claimed they had been tortured. The British government said it did not agree that the men were tortured, but wanted to avoid having to disclose sensitive material in open court and tie up the valuable time of its intelligence services. In a joint statement, Britain's domestic spy agency, M15, and its overseas intelligence service, M16, said the settlements would allow both agencies to concentrate on protecting national security. British Justice Secretary Ken Clark said open testimony from secret agents could jeopardize national security. A British lawyer with knowledge of the settlements told the Associated Press, on condition of anonymity, that at least seven former detainees would receive major payments and that one man would be receiving receiving more than $1.6 million. British spies have not been accused of torturing detainees themselves, but former victims have alleged that British officials violated international law by being fully aware of the abuse and doing absolutely nothing to stop it.
On a slightly more optimistic note, a 9-week strike by the Dutch public hygiene workers has been designated best union action of the last 5 years by an organization of 900 trade unions, UNI Global Union in Nagasaki, where they accepted their World Cup award recently. This strike, where cleaners suspended work, during which time rubbish piled up in public places like railway stations and airports and litter bins in university buildings, train interiors, and government public offices were not emptied and spilled over, forcing, after 6 weeks, employers and unions to begin tentative talks about the strikers' demands. Historian Sjaak van der Velden of the International Institute of Social History told reporters that this 9-week strike was the longest in the Netherlands since a fisherman's strike in 1933. 9 weeks being the longest strike in 77 years in that country. In this country, that's a good start.
Yes. Also this week, House Republicans blocked an effort to extend federal unemployment insurance benefits, making a lapse in benefits all but certain when they expire at the end of the month. House Democrats tried to speed the extension through by calling for a suspension of the rules, a procedure which requires a two-thirds majority. Although 258 members, a significant majority, supported the bill, the final vote fell short of the needed margin. The bill, H.R. 6419, would have extended unemployment insurance through February 2011 for those who have exhausted 26 weeks of insurance provided by states. It would also provide 100% federal funding to state unemployment programs to cover additional costs. A total of 143 Republicans and 11 Democrats voted against suspending the rules. Actually, 21 Republicans voted for it, including our own local Republican representative, Tim Johnson. If Congress does not act by November 30th, 800,000 people unable to find work in an economy with five job hunters out for every one job will lose this critical help that keeps a roof over their heads and food on the table. By the end of the year, 2 million jobless will be without help, and another 1 million a month will lose their benefits beginning next year. When the House and Senate wrap up business this week, they will not return until November 29th. And as House Ways and Means Chairman Sander Levin said, "I don't see how we can go home for Thanksgiving when hundreds of thousands of people may not have a turkey on their table because they can't afford it."
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up something about unemployment. A lot of people may not realize is being a real problem for building trades workers, and I'm running into it right now from what I saw on their website the other day, last night. And that is, see, like last year, I only had like 6 weeks of work that paid into unemployment at all. Most of my income came from unemployment last year. Well, like so many things in the United States, what you get as a benefit is based on, you know, what is paid in for you or what you pay in, you know, just like Social Security and everything else. And so that means that if you were really poor last year, well, you're going to be a lot poorer this year because your unemployment's going to get cut a whole bunch. And there's people who do have unemployment coming. But it is so low as to be hardly anything, and that's something that most people don't know about, and it's a real burden, and it's really it's almost counterintuitive. It's like you suffered last year by having a low income, so you're going to suffer this year by getting a really low benefit, even worse. You know, I don't know, but everybody in the, you didn't pay so much in, so you shouldn't get so much out. Oh, blah, blah, you're cheating. Oh, you're taking my money. Typical American foolish intra-class often envy.
All right, how about a little bit of Hightower Radio here? And Bill did join us here today, so thanks for coming, Bill. Appreciate it, always.
It appears to be a truly amazing feat of magic. Right before your eyes, this thing rises into the air on its own, with no wires or mechanical devices giving it lift, and it hovers there effortlessly. But it's not magic, for magic is an illusion, and this gravity-defying phenomena of perpetual levitation is real. What is this it that keeps floating up, up, up? The annual bonuses paid to Wall Street's top bankers. By the laws of economics, if not physics, bonuses should fall to earth this year because the bankers have performed poorly. Trading is down, profits are flat, despite being given trillions of dollars in almost interest-free money by the feds. Firms are firing lower-level employees, and banker greed has ruined the public reputations of the financial giants. Who cares, shriek the big shots? It's bonus time, baby, so grab all you can. The CEOs of Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and others have set aside billions of dollars to flood their executive suites with bonus cash at the end of the year, money that should go to shareholders. Their claim is, we deserve it, for we took low pay during the crash of 2008 and 2009. For example, Lloyd Blankfein, Goldman Sachs' boss, was paid a mere $9 million last year, so this year he wants that sacrifice to be made up to him. However, lest you worry that poor Lloyd's family needed food stamps to make ends meet in that tough $9 million year, note that he had a bit of a cushion, having pocketed a record Wall Street payday of $68 million in 2007, even as his bank was crumbling. This is Jim Hightower saying, one executive pay analyst says he assumed that bonuses would go down this year. But he said, I underestimated the industry's resiliency. By resiliency, I assume he was referring to greed.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Eric Kingson, co-chair of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, says that new polling shows very strong public opposition to cutting Social Security or raising the retirement age. Kingson says the Deficit Commission proposed cuts in Social Security would slash benefits by 35% for young workers just entering the workforce. Kingson says Social Security is a successful program. There's no need to cut it, and the public wants to lift the earnings cap on Social Security taxes instead to strengthen Social Security.
This is a program that's self-financed, that by law cannot run a deficit, and in fact is loaning the federal government $2.6 trillion. The public itself is very clear that scrapping the cap is the solution they see, or at least most favor, to Social Security. In fact, we could scrap the cap, and if we did just that alone, we would entirely address the projected Social Security shortfall beyond 75 years, and we could provide a modest benefit increase.
Pollster Celinda Lake says public opinion by large majorities is adamant that there be no cuts in Social Security.
People strongly oppose cutting Social Security benefits, whether we provide a rationale of reducing the deficit or making the program more solvent. They strongly oppose cutting benefits for those earning above 60. They strongly oppose raising the retirement age.
Grocery stores in northwestern Washington might be facing both a worker and turkey shortage come Thanksgiving. Jesse Russell reports.
The Teamsters have said they'll respect strike lines if they go up at grocery stores in the Puget Sound region of Washington State. 25,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers have authorized the negotiating team to call a strike if they run out of other options. They are in discussions with Albertsons, QFC, Fred Meyer, and Safeway. If the pickets do go up and the Teamsters respect the line, the stores might find they aren't only short workers during the busy Thanksgiving holiday, but also groceries. The union and the allied employers are sitting down for negotiations today. The current negotiations revolve around better coverage for medical benefits, but it also includes pay cuts for workers. The stores have been shopping for temporary workers in the event a strike does occur.
Ground workers at Delta Airlines have followed in the footsteps of flight attendants and voted down representation by organized labor. 52.5% of the total number of ballots cast were against representation by the International Association of Machinists. The next vote is by the customer service workers, who have until December 7th to finish balloting. The National Mediation Board may call for a new election for the flight attendants after some workers alleged Delta interfered with balloting. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And we're back. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and online at weft.org. And a little bit of Hightower Radio news and a little bit of Workers Independent news. And now we've come to that time in the program. Time for the Cultural Corner. This week, Tom Thomas's poem is When Will Representatives Represent?
We tell our kids that they are free to be just what they want to be, but that philosophy is warped and far too many just don't see. When millionaires don't pay the tax that poor folks are required to, there is no fairness in that act since we poor are more than a few. The reason that the poorer class has slim chance for recovery is because the rich and the fat are dining off our poverty. Most pay a third of what we make, not even knowing how it's spent. But if you made $5 million, you wouldn't have to pay a cent. Tax the royals with the money, and then distribute that around. Lining the pockets of the poor is where those dollars should be bound. To rebuild our fallen nation, we need to lay a foundation for solid Social Security and health care and education. Representatives represent the voters who gave you your jobs. That goes for you senators, too. Don't be a part of yesterday's mob. When Will Representatives Represent was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on November 15, 2010, and was first recited live November 20, 2010, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
All right, thanks, Tom. As a reminder, you can always tune in to Labor's View TV show, and that's Sundays at 4 o'clock on local Comcast Channel 6. And that stars our own David Johnson and also a friend of the show, Jim Iman. And also we want to send out a big thank you from all of us behind the mic here at WEFT for your support during our on-air fall pledge drive. If you have not yet made your contribution, please mail in your donation to WEFT, P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois, 61824, or simply donate online at weft.org. And you can also call us while the music is playing at 217-359-9338. And we open the show, as we usually do, with Pete Anderson, Working Class. Bill, were you saying a couple weeks ago that Pete had a new CD out?
No, I can't remember. I don't have the guitar magazine in front of me either.
I think you got a new CD just came out here in 2010.
Yeah, or a new signature guitar or something. Yeah, I can't remember now. But he's definitely a really, you know, he's probably not even that really well known to regular country western fans, but I understand that professionally in the business, he's like one of the biggest names.
Very highly esteemed and respected.
Producing and playing and so on.
And we're going to play a song now by Duke Robillard. He played last night, as a matter of fact, at a little club up in Saybrook, Illinois, the Shady Nook. So
really?
Yes. And I didn't head up there myself.
In Saybrook?
Yeah, the Shady Nook. It's a cool little bar, you know. So, but we missed it. Anyway, this is Duke Robillard doing Working Hard for My Uncle.
I was doing. They trying to make a living. The only way that I know how. For corporations are hiding millions. Politicians breaking every vow. I'll be here working for my uncle. Just like a bull that pulled a plow. By having fun, people. Ain't nothing left for buying clothes. I can't buy my baby diamonds or fancy stockings for her toes. How will I keep my baby happy? How will I keep her looking hot? Just working hard for my uncle is taking everything I got. I'm working hard for my uncle. Lord, and it's got me on the spot. Lord, it's got me on the spot. I'm working hard. Working hard. Lord, I'm working hard.
We're back. You are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org. And that was Duke Robillard working hard for his uncle. And we're back, and Jason's got a story for us. Jason?
A little bit of a story, a little bit of an aside, and then a song to play and a follow-up for that. Especially in conjunction with what David talked about last week, articulately, I think, talking about labor martyrs, especially right after Veterans Day, I thought it was a good idea and actually prompted me to consider a couple things. I consider every month really to be Labor History Month, but I would advocate, given how many events, pivotal events, some forgotten, some actually enormous, that November really ought to be considered, at least unofficially, before officially a Labor History Month, because there are really so many big things looking at it.
We remember.
Absolutely. Well said. The Committee on Industrial Organization was formed November 9th in 1935. This was out of the AFL, autonomous at the time, but ended up becoming the Congress of Industrial Organizations the following year. You had, in 1919, 1 year after World War One had ended, you had an attack between Legionnaires on the IWW and IWW members in Centralia, Washington, that resulted in the deaths of four Legionnaires members, and also widespread attacks on the IWW up there, which halted a campaign, but especially led to the lynching of an IWW organizer, Wesley Everest, not before he was castrated, I might add.
Really?
Yeah, emblematic of much of the violence that characterized not just Wobbly history, but really labor history and the way that people were treated and often humiliated. More recently, last year, I was proud to participate in the two-day successful strike of graduate assistants here at the University of Illinois.
Yes, the GEO. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really a pivotal strike.
Right.
Yes, I remember.
We were very happy with the result, too.
As were we as well. And, unfortunate for the university, but really I think the right outcome and over some pivotal issues, especially guaranteeing tuition waivers for out-of-state grads, where many graduates, including myself, come. November 10th in 1975 was when the Edmund Fitzgerald sank and prompted the great song by Gordon Lightfoot, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which is really not just about that tragedy, but I would say is really a work song as much mm-hmm. as anything.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday was the 95th anniversary of Joe Hill's execution in Utah. And there was an interesting set of circumstances, some of which comes up in this song by Billy Bragg and others, but just to give at least a little bit of an intro, that there were very dubious circumstances under which he was arrested and then subsequently tried. That didn't halt his being found guilty. And before he was executed, famously said to Big Bill Haywood, "Goodbye, Bill," in two telegrams, "Goodbye, Bill, I die like a true rebel. Don't waste any time in mourning. Organize." And then afterwards it said, "Could you arrange to have my body hauled to the state line to be buried? I don't want to be found dead in Utah." and ended up being executed. And this song memorializes him by quite well, I think, by Billy Bragg and others.
Of the crime that Joe was the they shot him down. He had nothing but guilt to give. It's a doctor I need, but they left him to bleed. And he made it cause he had the will to live. He made it cause he had the will to live. And the trial was set in a building of wood, and there a killer would be named. And the days weighed more than cold copper ore, cause he feared that he was being framed. Cause he feared that he was being framed. Now strange are the ways of the Western Lord, and strange are the ways of fate. For the government crawled to the mine owner's call, and the judge was appointed by the state. The judge was appointed by the state. Now Utah justice can be had, but not for a union man. And as Joe was warned by some early morn, there'd be one less singer in the band. There'd be one less singer in the band. Oh, William Spry was Governor Spry, and a life was his to hold. On the last appeal, fell governor's tear. May the Lord have mercy on your soul, Joe Hill. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. Now President Wilson held up the day, but even he would fail. For nobody heard the soul-searching words of the man in the Salt Lake City jail. Of the man in the Salt Lake City jail. Now for 36 years he lived out his days, and he more than played his part. For the songs that he made, he was carefully paid by a rifle bullet buried in his heart. By a rifle bullet buried in his heart.
That's Billy Bragg and others with the great tribute song to the labor and wobbly troubadour Joe Hill, who 95 years ago yesterday was executed in Utah under dubious circumstances. And as I was asked off air by Bill, there are a couple different very good books on the Wobblies generally and on Hill in particular that you can go to for a lot of this information, especially on their history. One I'd strongly recommend is Joyce Kornbluh's Rebel Voices. Another one is Melvin Dubofsky's We Shall Be All, one of the authoritative books on the IWW, both of which I'd highly recommend. Just briefly before getting to some stuff from Bill at the end, who has his, fittingly enough, his IWW t-shirt on today. There's an interesting story, a follow-up to Joe Hill, and really involves Billy Bragg, that an envelope of his ashes, long after the fact in 1988, was actually found in by a Postal Service employee with a photo inside of Joe Hill. It said, Joe Hill murdered by the capitalist class, November 19th, 1915. And its contents were put into the National Archives and subsequently remitted to the Wobblies actually after this. And people were wondering what to do with these ashes. And in these times, the great periodical had held a contest with soliciting different input about this. And Abby Hoffman, the late civil rights and anti-nuclear agitator, had suggested that the modern-day Joe Hills, like Michelle Schacht and Billy Bragg, ought to ingest some of the ashes, and others could be scattered about. And sure enough, Billy Bragg actually took and ate a very small piece of Joe Hill's ashes and is holding on until, I guess, Michelle Schacht decides to
communion.
Do so.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, I would bring something specific about Joe Hill. Was a few years ago, Public Broadcasting ran a documentary about him. I can't remember the name of it or anything, but I'm sure with Google or something, you could find it on their website, and it might be interesting to see if you could watch it somehow.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jason. Excellent. Yeah. Bill, you got something this week?
Well, something that comes up occasionally, and it's something maybe we all think about, or, it's like, what should we be doing now? A local guy was listening to the show, a musician, a few weeks ago, and he popped up chatting on Facebook, and he was just like, well, what can I do? And then another old Facebook friend of mine, Susan, from who now lives in Decatur, and I knew her way back in Bloomington at Illinois State, and didn't realize then at the time what an activist she was. But she's a lawyer now. She popped up somewhere yesterday, you know, wondering, you know, what she should do until the revolution.
Yeah.
And, well, for one thing she could do is strongly do her work. She's a lawyer for Social Security recipients, or probably for people who aren't receiving Social Security, but should be.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's good work. And that kind of also comes into where I'm talking about today. And something that I do is I study Buddhism quite a bit. I have for many years, even though I would never call or not call myself a Buddhist for various reasons. One, I don't practice meditation a lot, especially when I'm working, and I'm not a member of a group or what they would call a sangha. But something I've been doing lately is kind of becoming a fundamentalist Buddhist and going back to translations of what's known as the Pali canon, where they were speaking the language Pali, which was a precursor to Sanskrit. And at that time, these are the what the stories that come from Buddha's life, you know, what he said. You know, it would be like if you, it's sort of like the Jefferson Bible of Buddhism. It's like if you took the Bible and took out all the stuff that doesn't have really anything to do at all with Jesus, and then just put in most of that. I mean, really what Jesus said, I can agree with probably 90% of it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, very much. And so what you have is a lot of the suttas, or also known as sutras, you know, just the sayings and the stories of Buddha. And there's one of the things that you should do, and the key to Buddhism is called the Eightfold Path, which is what you follow rather than a Ten Commandments, but there's, it's practices of living. You know, and one of the, and some of it has to do with speech. And one of the parts of the Eightfold Path is to practice right speech, as well as things like right concentration, which is meditation, and not killing and not stealing, you know, and so on and so forth. And but anyway, right speech, and you should not indulge in lies. You know, you should not indulge in harsh speech, which I wonder about with myself and with other people into activism, because my shtick on the show is harsh speech.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people get into that in various ways in their writings and, of course, and everything else. And people in politics, people love to do that. Mm-hmm. It's a rhetorical style part of it. And, but I'm just wondering, you know, is that, how good or bad is that? You know, what would Buddha think about it? And how does it tie into what we should be doing to bring the revolution? And it's something that people get sticky about quite a bit. Like, oh, well, you called my side Nazis, and you called my side Nazis, and you guys called George Bush Nazis a long time before we called Barack Obama a Nazi, and all this and that. Well, anyway, there's, I came across this story yesterday in my studies, and it's from what's called the Middle Length Discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's in the Pali, it's known as the Abhayara Jaka Kumara Sutta, or it's number 58, called To Prince Abhaya. And what it is Prince Abhaya was a follower of another teacher, as there were several people teaching in Buddhist time. And this teacher wanted him to go to Buddha and ask him about the speech he's been saying about another person, saying that that person will not have a good next life, will probably be going to hell, or some sort of Buddhist idea of hell, which is, there's various ones. I don't, you don't need to get into that. But anyway, and this is to see, I guess, to test Buddha about whether he is, his things about harsh speech. Well, what they're saying, while this story comes on, Prince Abhaya comes and he sits down. And while he's sitting there, there is a child on his lap, a very small child. And anyway, the Prince Abhaya asks him about this speech. He says, then, venerable sir, why have you declared of Devadatta?
Devadatta is destined for the states of deprivation. Devadatta is destined for hell. Devadatta will remain in hell for the aeon. Devadatta is incorrigible. And then he goes on to say, Devadatta was angry and displeased with that speech of yours. Well, they don't tell us who Devadatta is or why he's going to hell. But anyway, well, then the recluse Gautama, which many people know as Buddha's, one of Buddha's other names, is poised. Okay. When the recluse Gautama is posed, this two-horned questioned by you, he will not be able to either throw it up or gulp it down. If an iron spike were stuck in a man's throat, he would not be able to either throw it up or gulp it down. So what they're doing is trying to get Buddha on the horns of a dilemma here with this two-pronged question. Well, anyway, there's the baby on the lap, and Buddha, he says, yes, it's Prince Abhaya. He goes, if there was something that got down in this baby's throat and was caught in there and would cause the baby to choke, what would you do? Well, the prince says, well, I would stick my finger down into his throat and pull it out, even if it caused it to bleed, caused the baby's throat to bleed. And then, but it's, you know, he talks about it. He says, well, yes, you know, of course, I did say these things about Devadatta, and they are harsh things to say, but they are the true things. You know, and just like with the baby's throat, Devadatta needs to hear these things so he can correct his statements, his behavior, whatever it is that that Buddha sees that is wrong. So, Prince, such speech as the Tathagata, another name for Buddha, knows to be untrue, incorrect, and beneficial, which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others. Pretty much just, nah. Such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others. Such speech the Tathagata does not utter. That would be like me coming on here and telling you a whole bunch of things that wouldn't do you any good, and that also bums you out to listen to. You know, it doesn't matter if it's true and correct, but it doesn't help you any. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be untrue, incorrect, unbeneficial, but which is welcome and agreeable to others. You know, such speech as, say, maybe like Rush Limbaugh talks about to his audience. Well, no, that's not good either, because it's unbeneficial and in all ways is bad. But anyway, folks, what I want you to know is that what we are doing is really more of a process of communication. That's any type of politics. That's what activism is about. What we have really basically are public relations and campaigns that are opposing each other on various issues. The United States, the basic political, this is what they teach you in a public relations class. The United States' basic political system is based on a theory called public interest liberalism, which is where we do have our rights and so on and so forth, but things are determined mainly by the actions and influences of various public interest groups using rhetoric in whatever forms, whether that be direct speech, media, or whatever, getting the political changes that they need and want. And that's what we have to be pursuing. And we have new means of doing that. I've referred two or three times here to Facebook. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this, finding this story about Buddha on the internet. And unlike the old days when we all lived in the same neighborhoods, around the same factory that we all worked in, and we went to the same bars, and we went to the same churches, and we went to the same barbers and grocery stores, and we talked with each other, and we raised each other's consciousness constantly about our civilization, yes, about our situation, our plight in this civilization, and what we can do. See, I was always amazed how people without electronic communication could organize until I thought about that. Well, now we do have, we were kind of separated for a while where we got mail, direct mail and phone trees and stuff. But now we have this direct thing on the internet. And it's like I told Susan, you know, do what you can, talk to people how you can without being obnoxious. Try and get some kind of point across. Use humor. And probably one of the most important things you can do is to encourage.